From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I spent 2.5 years in a re-education through labor camp, and the conditions there was unbelievably harsh.
We speak with Chinese dissident Teng Yi as the Chinese president prepares to meet with President Clinton. Feminist groups denounce Nike's women empowerment ads here at home, while Nike exploits women and girl workers in Asia. We'll have a debate. The fall on Wall Street, and as the U.S. sends more weapons for the so-called drug war in Colombia, who are they pointed at? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A worldwide plunge in stock prices erased more than 7% from the Dow Jones Industrial Average yesterday and forced the New York Stock Exchange to halt trading. The only other interruptions like this came after the wounding of President Ronald Reagan and the assassination of President John Kennedy. No one knew just how far the market might have fallen had not market rules adopted in the wake of a stock market crash 10 years ago required the exchange and other American stock markets to close at 3:30 in the afternoon, half an hour before the scheduled 4 o'clock closing bell. The tumble further unnerved Asian markets as trading resumed there. And after the midday break today, Hong Kong stocks were down more than 12%, the sharpest fall since 1989. Chinese leader Jiang Zemin arrived in Williamsburg, Virginia today before flying to Washington for meetings with President Clinton and other government leaders. Jiang's first stop of his 8-day U.S. visit was Honolulu, where he was given a 21-gun salute and placed a wreath at the USS Arizona Memorial, addressing also a dinner in his honor at the Hawaii governor's residence. Jiang also is scheduled to travel to Philadelphia, New York, Cambridge, Massachusetts, Los Angeles before leaving on November 2nd. U.S. Senator Fred Thompson, the Republican of Tennessee, says he will not press President Clinton to testify before his Governmental Affairs Committee about apparent campaign finance abuses. Thompson made the comment on CBS's Face the Nation in a letter made public over the weekend. White House counsel Charles Ruff told the committee the administration remained willing to cooperate but considered it inappropriate for Clinton to testify. Meanwhile, White House tapes from 1971 show that President Nixon ordered his aides to dig up unflattering information on Democrats and to commit two break-ins about a year before the Watergate affair. This, according to Newsweek this week, the tapes reveal Nixon wanting files at the National Archives ransacked to find anything to smear Democratic presidents from Franklin Roosevelt to John Kennedy. It also quoted Nixon. That's Newsweek quoted Nixon ordering a break-in at the Brookings Institution in retaliation against Daniel Ellsberg, a Brookings employee who had leaked the so-called Pentagon Papers to the media. An Indonesian couple who contributed $450,000 to the Democrats told Senate investigators that John Huang urged them to support the Democratic Party in mid-1995 when he was still a Commerce Department official and legally barred from soliciting donations. Huang's lawyer denies he violated any ban. A Miami jury acquitted two American lawyers for Colombia's Cali cocaine cartel on charges of racketeering, handing a major defeat to the U.S. government. Meanwhile, early results in Colombia indicated President Samper's ruling party kept a majority of state and local posts in voting on Sunday. Argentina's President Menem conceded defeat of his Peronist party in congressional elections, but argued the center-left alliance had embraced his economic policies. Menem now must work closely with the alliance during the final 2 years of his term. Britain and its former colonies concluded their summit with a commitment to free trade and a warning to Nigeria's military junta. The 54-nation Commonwealth said the African nation will be expelled if the military remains in power past 1998, but refused to sanction it now. South African President Nelson Mandela will return to Libya tomorrow to discuss an issue that arose last week during talks in Tripoli with Muammar Gaddafi. A South African presidential aide wouldn't disclose the subject of the very brief meeting. And this from the entertainment column of the Washington Post today. Veteran peace activist Philip Berrigan, 74 years old, received his latest punishment in federal court in Portland, Maine yesterday, 2 years in prison. Convicted last spring of conspiracy and destruction of government property, a cadre of Plowshares protesters boarded a guided missile destroyer and symbolically defaced it with blood and hammer blows. The former priest also got 2 years probation. He and five other defendants must repay the Navy a total of more than $28,000. Berrigan gets credit for the 8 months he has already spent in a county jail. Very entertaining. And this news from ABC Entertainment, they say they are reintroducing a parental advisory for tomorrow night's episode of Ellen. And the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation yesterday expressed its dismay over the network decision. The advisory was removed 2 weeks ago after series star Ellen DeGeneres and gay rights groups complained about use of a warning usually applied to explicit violent sex or language. This week's episode and several to come will feature Ellen continuing coming out process and the introduction of the character's first girlfriend. And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Sportswear giant Nike is facing trouble again. Already reeling from charges that it exploits children in its factories in Indonesia and Vietnam, women's groups are now slamming the multinational company over its new advertising campaign. Television commercials show women saying they'll be stronger, healthier, and more independent if they're allowed to play sports and wear Nike products. In fact, this is one of those ads. See if you can understand it. It's about a girl first getting a doll and then getting a ball.
There's a girl being born in America, and someone will give her a doll, and someone will give her a ball, and then someone will give her a chance.
Now, a coalition of women's groups say the ad reaches a new level of hypocrisy since Nike employs women and girls in its Asian factories at low pay under poor conditions. We're joined now by two people to discuss this issue. Eleanor Smeal is with us. She's president of the Feminist Majority Foundation, which is a research and advocacy group promoting social, economic, and political equality for women. We're also joined on the telephone by Vishere Korpas. She is a spokesperson for Nike. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Eleanor Smeal. You're holding a news conference today at 11 o'clock. Can you tell us what this is all about?
Yes, what it is about is that women's groups want to call attention to the fact that we think that the Nike ads that for women's empowerment are very strong, but we are very concerned with the disconnect between those ads and what's happening in Southeast Asia to women workers, where some of them are barely getting enough money to eat, let alone live on. So what we want is better treatment of the women workers in what are clearly sweatshops of Southeast Asia.
Vishere Korpas of Nike, can you tell us your reaction to that?
Well, first of all, thank you, Eleanor. I appreciate you liking our ads, but I think that Nike has garnered a well-deserved reputation for empowering women in sports and empowering women in the workplace, not only in the U.S., but through our manufacturing overseas. What's disturbing to us is that the well-intentioned participants in today's press conference have been misled by Global Exchange, a group which has consistently made outrageous and inaccurate statements about Nike's labor practices.
Well, I'm not quite sure what you think is inaccurate. One of the things that we think that should happen, and then there wouldn't be a dispute over the figures, is if an independent bodies could monitor both wages and working conditions. But wages are extremely low in Southeast Asia. We're talking about places where they're making 20, 30, 40 cents an hour, as low as $1.60 a day, some places $2 a day, some places $3 a day. But it's very, very low wages. And basically, I think Americans as a whole have somewhat of a misconception that low wages abroad are because standards of living are so low, when in reality, these folks have a terrible time just eating, let alone paying the rent or clothing or for that matter, can they even afford a Nike pair of shoes? And what we're saying is empowerment for women, we got to think of it worldwide, that we can't here in the United States forget the global impact of these tremendously low wages abroad, especially to women workers in these kinds of factories.
Let's take each of the points that you just raised and have Vishere Korpas respond to them. The first point you raised, Eleanor Smeal, is the issue of independent monitors.
Right.
Nike spokesperson Vishere Korpos, why not allow independent monitoring groups into the plants in Vietnam, in Indonesia, in China?
Well, in fact, we've had an independent monitoring group, the accounting firm of Ernst & Young, and actually now Pricewaterhouse, monitoring our overseas practices for the last 3 to 4 years, including we've also had a well-renowned civil rights leader, Andrew Young, visit our factories just recently and come back with a report that basically these jobs exist in good working conditions.
But let me just clarify. In all three cases, they were paid by Nike and they reported to Nike.
Yes, they are. And
so
it's not unusual for a business to do that.
Right, but the Global Exchange, my understanding is Global Exchange and other human
right.
rights groups have asked for independent monitors.
Right, and we will entertain that idea, but I mean the reputation of Ernst & Young and Pricewaterhouse and Andrew Young, these are fairly credible organizations and individuals that have come back to us and other people who have visited our factories who have come back to us and say, yes, you are doing a good job and you can do better, and that's what our goal is to do better. And in the area, speaking of jobs, I mean, our overseas practices have generated 500,000 jobs around the world. And these are good jobs. They're good paying jobs and they exist in good conditions. And we're proud of that, but we know we can do better and we're trying.
Well, we think that it's great that there are more jobs. I mean, obviously they need the jobs. But, you know, you can't say good pay when, you know, even your figures would have these extremely low-paid jobs. But we're talking also about these independent monitors for people not only not paid by Nike, but people who are can speak the language and can really talk to the workers. Because basically having people who speak English, like all due respect to Andrew Young or I think the Dartmouth group that went there, and having translators, I think it would be far better if they were natives that could speak the language, could get in there, and would have an independent source of pay. That's what we're talking about, so that we would then all have some agreed-upon numbers to deal with here.
But, I mean, really, let's not discount the Dartmouth study that did visit and interview workers and take information from the World Bank and basically came back and said that we do pay a living wage and that these workers are working enough and earning and have enough of a discretionary income to save and send money back to families or use it as discretionary income. And we think that's great news. I mean, it's not us talking, it's Dartmouth talking.
Well, but it's also Dartmouth. Weren't they all English-speaking, really, coming from Dartmouth and also paid by Nike? I mean, it wasn't really...
Well, I mean, but the study Dartmouth also does research for companies like Citibank and Disney.
Oh.
So clearly there is some credibility there. I mean, this is a very credible academic institution we're referring to.
Again, though, what we're saying is it would be helpful for everybody. We wouldn't have to disagree on numbers if it was an independent body that was familiar with the language. And because what is happening, and the reason why there is this dispute, is the independent groups, the human rights groups based in Southeast Asia, are telling us a different story, that the numbers are very low, the living conditions for these women are very harsh, and that there's sexual harassment and abuse.
We're talking to Eleanor Smeal and Vishere Korpos. Eleanor Smeal, president of the Feminist Majority Foundation, which is one of a number of groups today, including the Ms. Foundation and Global Exchange and others, who will be holding a news conference in Washington, D.C. to criticize Nike for their female empowerment ads here in the United States as they pay the women and girl workers in Indonesia, Vietnam, China, and Asia. Wages of, I guess it's around, I think in Indonesia, now equivalent to around $1.60 a day. We're also talking to Vishere Korpos, who is a spokesperson for Nike. She, too, is on the phone with us from Washington, D.C. I had a question for Vishere Korpos, and that is this. I always wondered about this over these years where the issue of human rights violations and Nike have become more prominent. Why doesn't Nike simply pay, let's say, double the minimum wage? Let's say they're to the workers, the thousands of women and girls that they employ in Indonesia, just double, pay double the minimum wage. I mean, You're talking about, for example, Phil Knight making to the tune of in a recent quarterly estimate $80 million from his stocks. It would mean slightly less profit, but it would certainly the company is extremely profitable. And it would mean the difference between malnourished women and girls and not. Why not just double it?
Well, actually, you know, the minimum wage that is required by law in various countries actually work to protect workers in those countries. However, Nike actually pays well above the minimum wage in those countries, and they actually pay a living wage. So for the most part, you're asking us if whether or not we pay double. Actually, we pay fairly close to double. And many of the, I mean, we're talking about emerging economies where we do have to respect the economic scale of wages. But just know that in some instances, for instance, I think in Indonesia, the minimum wage for a Indonesian or maybe a Vietnamese-owned factory is actually less than that of what is required for a foreign factory.
But the fact is, when you say you pay close to double, you're talking about, we just had a debate between Veda Manager, another spokesperson for Nike, and Medea Benjamin of Global Exchange, and she pointed out that when you talk about paying more than the minimum wage, that you're talking about overtime and averaging that in, these extremely long hours that the women and girls are often made to work so that they are not being paid double the minimum wage.
Well, actually, I mean, I think, as I said, it's important to look at the Dartmouth study to note that these workers are actually being paid good wages and they earn enough to save and have a discretionary income.
What
I think that's a very important finding.
What are you calling a good wage?
A good wage is a wage where you can earn enough
to save. What price are you putting on it?
Excuse me?
What? How many cents an hour?
Well, I mean, let's take Indonesia and Vietnam, or the Dartmouth, like, let's just call back to the Dartmouth study, where they found that the minimum wage in Indonesia and Vietnam are between 20 per month, is about 26 to 29. The Nike wage,
that's
in
cents an hour?
No, $26 to $29 a month. That's the required minimum wage.
Just think about that, how much that would break down to an hour, and consider some of these women are working 12 hours a day, six days a week.
Nike is actually paying about $45 to $56 a month.
Yeah, I know, but to figure that out for 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, what that comes an hour. You're talking about pennies. I mean, even there, you can't live on it.
Yeah, I think we're also talking
different. You can't use the word good for that.
Eleanor, I also think that we're talking about different economic scales, and as a Filipino-American, I pretty much know what different economic scales are.
Well, what I should do is tell you what a McDonald's is. I mean, you know, what I'm trying to say is that food isn't that cheap even there. I mean, and we're talking about less, you know, 20 cents an hour.
The Dartmouth study also found that the cost of food expenditures per day is 43 cents per day.
Well,
so if you do the math, clearly there is there is a discretionary income given the earnings that they're making with Nike.
Bashar Karvas, I've been looking at all these studies. The Dartmouth study said that a person could get by one person supporting a family of four. And yet there was a UNDP, that's the United Nations Development Program study, that looked at 200 women, and they were under the care of Indonesian physicians. And they found that, and they did very careful studies, actually blood samples and urine samples and everything, to really look at their health. And they found that 88% of the women who worked in the factories were malnourished. So there's a real contrast between this Dartmouth study that says a family of four could live on one worker's wages, and also even the Indonesian government that says their minimum wage does not keep one person, even one person, above the poverty line.
Let alone four.
Well, we certainly care about that study, and we'll take a look at it. And there have been conflicting studies on wages and what minimum wage or what constitutes a minimum wage and a living wage.
Well, some of the experts are saying that if Nike just reduced their advertising budget 10%, it would substantially raise wages throughout in these three countries.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to leave this discussion alone, but we're going to have a continued discussion on this. We just a few weeks ago spoke with Nike and Global Exchange. Today we're speaking with Eleanor Smeal, the president of the Feminist Majority Foundation, a research and advocacy group based in Washington, D.C., and Vishir Karpos, who is a spokesperson for Nike, based in Beaverton, Oregon, but she is today in Washington, D.C. as well. We want to thank you both very much for joining us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and in a little while we're going to find out about that fall on Wall Street that began in the Asian Wall Streets, if you will. And then we're going to be talking about military aid to Colombia. But right now, we're going to continue talking about human rights. President Jiang Zemin of China visits Virginia today, just one step ahead of the summit talks and state dinner slated for Washington, D.C. tomorrow with the American president, Clinton. But the Chinese president will not be getting a warm welcome from human rights activists. They will be holding protest rallies condemning China's human rights record, and in particular the bloody 1989 crackdown in Tiananmen Square, and in its aftermath, the many political prisoners who are being held at detention camps around China. Yesterday, I had a chance to catch up with Tong Yi, who is a former assistant to China's leading dissident, Wei Jingsheng. Tong Yi was free only last year from prison, where she spent 2.5 years because of her links to Wei Jingsheng. She arrived in the United States this summer and is presently enrolled at Columbia University in a master's degree program in political science. I caught up with her at Penn Station in New York City, where she was boarding an Amtrak train, this before the imminent strike, if that's to happen, with a group of her colleagues. She's headed down to Washington for a news conference today that she'll be holding at the National Press Club, along with Tibetan dissidents, and there'll be protests she'll be participating in throughout the week. And I asked her to tell me about why she is holding the news conference and participating in the protests.
You could already see I with my colleagues, and we will go into Washington D.C. to protest President Jiang Zemin's visit here because of human rights abuses in China.
Tell me your story.
I was the former assistant to Mr. Wei Jingsheng, the most prominent dissident in China, and he spent last 18 years in prison, except only 6 months period of freedom. And during that time, I worked for him. And his rearrest was closely associated with the meeting with the Assistant Secretary of State, Mr. John Shadak. So I already applied, you know, a plea or court for President Clinton to put more pressure to win Mr. Wei Jingsheng's early release. But we failed. Our hopes have been dashed again.
President Clinton says that if you open the markets to China, that that will lead to human rights improvements.
I don't agree with him. Since his delinked decision, delinked MFN.
He delinked.
He delinked human rights with from MFN in 1994. The human rights abuses in China become severe. The crackdown on dissidents become more severe in China. So you can tell the economic development doesn't mean necessarily automatically will lead to political reform. Still, political reform has a long way to go in China, and the Chinese government still doesn't allow any open, decent voices heard in China.
Tell me about your own story, Tang Yi.
Uh-huh. I spent 2.5 years in a re-education through labor camp, and the conditions there was unbelievably harsh, and I never expected that before I went there. And there, the detainees was forced to work 18 hours a day without any, you know, rest, without any pay, and they produced a production for export. Say in our labor camp, they produced battery for export. So, and the conditions there is very, very harsh, and the police women just forced just control every minute of the detainees' freedom.
Were you physically beaten?
Yes, yes. When I just arrived there, I rejected to work overnight at night. I claim that the Lord stipulated that we could only work 8 hours a day, but they forced us to work 18 hours a day. So I rejected, and I was beaten by the fellow inmates. And my story was broadcasted by the Voice of America, and then the government faced some pressure from the outside world, and then my condition there gradually improved. So I want to say international pressure really works. They could really help to improve human rights in China. And I think U.S. government should do more in this respect.
I understand that you heard about President Clinton de-linking human rights to most favored nation trade status when you were in the camp.
Yes, yes. I was in the cell. I heard that announcement through a loudspeaker in the cell, and I was shocked when I heard it because U.S. government already, you know, took a step forward to support support a dissident in China by arranging a meeting between Mr. Zhang Shadek and Mr. Wei Jinsheng. And then when Wei Jinsheng was detained again, Mr. President just delinked that MFN delinked human rights from MFN. So there's no hope for Mr. Wei Jinsheng to get out at that time. I realized it. I was very, very disappointed.
We've just walked into the train now. I'll stand with you before it leaves. What will happen to Wei Jinsheng now, do you think, as a result of the summit?
Because before the summit, we had some hope for his early release, but our hopes have been dashed again. So he now is dying in prison. I'm very worried about his conditions there. His cell now changed to something like a glassy cage, and the two walls has turned into big, big glasses, and one watched by...
You're saying that the walls are both glass on either side of his room?
Yes, and one watched by the guards and one watched by the fellow inmates. And now they have even limited his access to bathroom. It's totally inhuman. And
why is he being held?
To me, it's very clear because he was not trying to overthrow the Chinese government, but only because of his association with U.S. officials at the request of U.S. government. Because 80% of my interrogation was totally about the association between the U.S. government and Mr. Wei Jinsheng. So you can tell from that evidence that Mr. Wei Jinsheng's fate was closely associated with U.S.-China policy.
In what way? Because he met with the American officials, he's being punished for that?
Yes, definitely. Yes. To me, it's quite clear.
And why was he held for the first 14 years?
Oh, the first 40 years, he wrote some articles criticize Mr. Deng Xiaoping by name to claim that we must warn that a new dictatorship would happen in China. So Deng Xiaoping was outraged and put him into jail. And also Mr. Wei Jinsheng called for the fifth modernization democracy in China. And that's a totally resonant slogan in China, because in China people always called for realizing four modernization, something like industrial, agricultural, science and technology and defense modernizations in China, if China wants to catch up with the other advanced countries in 20th century. So Mr. Wei Jinsheng said if there's no democracy in China, other modernizations are nonsense, are meaningless. So he was detained for because of his dissent.
And he knew he faced great risk when he came out after 14 years and started writing articles for overseas Chinese press, and that's something you were helping him with.
Yes, yes. And he didn't yield to the foreign pressure or a great threat from the Chinese government, because he still holds a very strong faith in freedom of speech and freedom of association and those basic ideals of democracy and human rights. And he didn't care about the outcome, whether he would suffer it again or not.
What is he dying of in prison?
He had already, you know, developed a very heavy heart disease, and also he developed a new skin ailment now.
When he came out of prison, you knew that you were also risking your own life, certainly your own freedom, by working with him. Why did you choose to do that?
After I read his prison letters, you know, when I met him, I was deeply inspired by his courage and his wisdom. I saw at that time that my working with him is the most important thing for me to do in my whole life. So I just decided to stay with him and didn't care about those threats or the serious consequences happened to me. So he's the guy who can inspire many, many common people to just follow him, to push ahead the course toward democracy in China. So he's a symbol of the whole pro-democracy movement in China.
Your parents were also brave, because they were threatened when they spoke out on your behalf when you were in a labor prison camp.
Yes. I do appreciate my parents, you know, efforts to help me to improve my conditions when I was detained in labor camp. My mother and my father suffered both psychologically and physically, you know. After I was detained, my father developed a great, you know, very serious diseases. And now they were happy. They are happy now. I'm free now in the United States, and they got relief. They are very happy now, because I'm already insecure, insured my own security now in the U.S.
Have a good trip to Washington.
Thank you.
And so Tung Yi headed off to Washington, D.C. for a news conference today that she is holding. Tung Yi, a former assistant to China's leading dissident, Wei Jingsheng. She was free only last year from a labor camp where she spent 2.5 years because of her links to Wei. She arrived in the United States this summer and is enrolled at Columbia University in a master's degree program in political science. Among her teachers, former White House assistant George Stephanopoulos. And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Well, first, the Asian financial markets were shaken. Then it moved to Wall Street. Yesterday, the financial markets plunged to their biggest one-day point loss in history. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 7.2% Monday, the largest one-day percentage drop since October 1987. Some are calling it Black Monday 2. We're joined right now by Doug Henwood. He's the editor of the Left Business Observer, an economic newsletter, and the author of Wall Street, How It Works and For Whom, which was recently published by Verso Press. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Doug.
Be here.
Well, what does this mean?
Well, that's hard to say. I mean, it's a terrible thing for a pundit to confess to uncertainty, but I think to have to be honest that it's really hard to say whether this is just a little financial storm or the onset of something more serious. And I'm referring both to what's been going on in Asia and what's sort of been spread to the rest of the world. It's not clear whether, like, what's happened in Asia over the last several months is really the end of that great boom, which is really one of the great booms of economic history. And it's not really clear yet whether this is the end of this long 1990s expansion in the U.S. and whether tough times are ahead. I don't know. I think it's going to take us a little while to figure this all out.
Who does this hurt?
Well, right at the moment, it doesn't, in the U.S., it doesn't hurt anybody unless they've got a lot of money wrapped up in the market. It's not to the point yet where it's of, I think, general economic concern. It's not at the point yet where it's likely to cause serious financial problems or any kind of serious repercussions. If it does continue, then it can hurt just about everyone. But one, you know, people have come to think these... Well, let's see, when the 1987 stock market crash happened, the first thing in everyone's mind was 1929. Now, when the 1997 stock market crash happened, the first thing in everyone's mind is 1987, meaning that you know, this will all pass and things will just go back to normal and the market will continue to go up forever. I don't know. The people who thought of 1929 and 1987 were wrong. I don't know whether the people who are thinking of 1987 today as the precedent are right or wrong either, but... I think the most immediate damage, though, is done to all these people who'd plunge into the stock market over the last several years, stock market virgins who are discovering that the market can go both ways. They've come to think of 20% annual returns as their birthright, and it doesn't always work that way.
Doug Henwood, what about people who didn't want to be involved with the stock market, people who work, who now find their pension plans, 401ks, that basically have been privatized, and so they are investing in the stock market? What happens to these pensions?
This is one of the things that corporate America has done over the last several years, is switch the risk more to the employee. Back in the old traditional pension fund, the so-called defined benefit plan, the risk was on the employer to come up with the money to pay the pension that they'd promised. Now they're shifting it all to the employee. The employee is maybe gets some help and contributions, but the employee is responsible for managing the money properly and making sure there's enough money when he or she wants to retire. So it's good news for the pension for the employer, but it's not so good news for employees who are really swimming in very dangerous waters. And I think, you know, there are an awful lot of people invested in the stock market these days who really don't understand the first thing about it. And, you know, all these people also seriously talking about privatizing the Social Security system and putting our money in the stock market is even even a scarier proposition. It's just, it's not a game for people who are new to it. And unfortunately, there are plenty of people who are new to it playing the game.
In fact, what do you think this will do to that whole discussion that Democrats and Republicans are pushing for in Congress right now, that whole issue of privatization of Social Security and investing it in the stock market?
Well, if there's an upside to the stock market crash collapse, it might be that people will stop talking about this preposterous idea of privatizing Social Security. The system works very well as it is now, is really not facing anything like the financial crisis that people, the alarmists, say that it is. But it's just become almost a matter of faith now, an article of faith in American politics that it has to be done. And the only question is exactly how and how much. But it's really a tragedy that this thing has become such a certainty, because the stock market is really a very, very dangerous game to play with.
Doug Henwood, I was struck last night watching local and national newscasts at how many people were interviewed outside of the experts, people on the street, who I was very surprised said that they were going to be affected by the ups and downs of the stock market. Even though more people are invested in the stock market, whether through pensions or just because they've gotten involved now, what about the concentration of who holds the wealth in the stock market? How does that skew?
Oh, it's still intensely concentrated. I mean, for many decades, most of the 70s and 80s and into the early 90s, only about 20% of the population owned stocks at all, either directly or through a mutual fund. That number has more or less doubled over the last several years to about 40%. But still, wealth is so intensely concentrated in this country that it's still a matter of the very upper reaches of society. The top 1% of the population has as much wealth as the bottom 90%. And within that bottom 90%, things are very concentrated in the upper end of that. So the bottom 60 or 70% of society has very, very little wealth at all of any kind. In 1992, the most recent year, we've got numbers for the top 5% of stockholders held 95% of the stock held by individuals. So even if that's spread out a little bit, it's still intensely concentrated. And I think you really need to think of the stock market as a mechanism by which the very rich as a group can own the productive assets of the economy. And all this following of the gyrations of the prices shouldn't obscure the fact that it's really a mechanism of ownership and control, and those owners and controllers have become much more assertive in recent years about exercising that control. They've really been the leaders in forcing the downsizing agenda on American corporations and laying people off and cutting wages and making job insecurity a way of life. And they're not usually blamed for this, but it's really they're the ones that are the guilty parties.
In fact, we've often found that when a corporation downsizes, their stock prices go up. Does this mean with stocks going down that more people are going to be employed?
Well, I don't know if it's going to work in reverse, but the reason that that happened is that as there's less money paid out to employees, there's more money available for profits and for shareholders. The emphasis in recent years, thanks to the increasing influence of shareholders, has been on getting more money onto Wall Street more quickly. And if that means laying off a lot of people, well, all to the good. If that means cutting back in research and development or investment in the underlying business, well, from Wall Street's point of view, that's good too. So they're really putting long-term prosperity at risk to get the bull market going. But it's been a wonderful ride from Wall Street's point of view.
Well, Doug Henwood, I want to thank you very much for joining us, editor of the Left Business Observer, an economics newsletter, author of Wall Street, How It Works and For Whom. It's published by Verso Press. And if people want to get a hold of Left Business Observer, where can they call, Doug?
They can give us a call at 212-874-4020 or look us up on Yahoo on the web, and you can check out the LBO website as well.
That's 212-874-4020. Doug Henwood, thanks for being with us. I'm sure we'll be checking back with you soon. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, who are those U.S. weapons pointed at in Colombia? Stay with us.
Family Name, a filmmaker's search for his namesake, leads Mackie Alston, who is white, to trace the histories of the other Alstons he knew in his Durham, North Carolina elementary school, who are not. Family Name, which opened to great reviews at the Lemley Grand, is now playing Saturday and Sunday mornings at the Sunset 5. Soon to come is Artist Revolution, about the Prague turnover led by poets and playwrights. Send a self-addressed stamped envelope, a photocopy of your film club card, and a request for either or both films to the KPFK Film Club at the station's North Hollywood address.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. Drug Czar General Barry McCaffrey, on a visit to the South American country of Colombia last week, officially approved increased U.S. military involvement in fighting Colombian rebel forces. Some $150 million in U.S. military aid this year, triple last year's amount, is supposed to be used against drug traffickers. But President Clinton and General McCaffrey are now asserting that the rebels are drug traffickers and that the U.S. military aid can officially be used directly against the guerrillas. Washington's also considering $50 million more in aid to Colombia's security forces to fight the guerrillas, who now control vast areas of Colombia. But military aid to Colombia has long been contested. Lethal aid was suspended in 1994 after a government accounting office report found that such support had gone directly to units accused of massive human rights violations. In addition, Washington repeatedly charged earlier this year that Colombian President Ernesto Samper was involved with drug traffickers. Also this weekend, municipal elections were held throughout Colombia. Joining us to talk about what's going on in Colombia right now, where this military aid is going, what happened with the elections, are two guests. We're joined by Mark Chernik, professor of government and Latin American studies at Georgetown University, author of many articles on drug trafficking and violence in Colombia and the Andean region. And we're also joined by Jael Quiroga, who is director of Reinitiate. It is an NGO, human rights organization, that's based in Colombia. Let's start with Professor Chernik. Can you explain what this turnaround is?
Turnaround in U.S. policy?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of now saying that the military aid can directly go to fight the guerrillas.
Well, there's something...
Or is it a turnaround?
Well, there's something very interesting happening in Washington, and it's very recent. It's still inchoate. It's not fully developed. And that is that the State Department policymakers who deal with Colombia seem to have just discovered that there's more than drug trafficking in Colombia, that there is an immense problem of violence, and that there's a strong guerrilla insurgency, which is stronger today than at any time during the last 30 years. And so they're beginning to say, uh-oh, maybe we've pushed too hard against the Samper government. Maybe we should be concerned about other things than drug trafficking. We need to be concerned about political stability. Now, that wider perception is perhaps a good development, but it could be a negative development. And McCaffrey's trip may indicate that it's a negative development, because they're now saying military aid can be used for anything. And in fact, they've collapsed two problems and two issues, drug trafficking and guerrilla insurgency, into one, and have basically bought into the idea of a narco-guerrilla. This is dangerous politics.
We're talking to Professor Mark Chernik, Professor of Government and Latin American Studies at Georgetown University. What about these elections this past weekend? There's been a couple of interesting stories in the New York Times. Today, there's an analysis piece. There was a long piece on Saturday. In today's paper, it says what mattered most in the voting was not who won or what the candidates stood for, but rather how many people could vote at all in an election that, in effect, revealed the existence of two Colombias, one where people could choose their mayors and another where democracy was so frail that they could not.
Well, that's accurate. It's also a new development, oddly enough. Up till now, the guerrillas have not had a strategy of disrupting elections. And I mean, up to now, during the past several decades, there have been occasional instances. But for the most part, the guerrillas have had candidates that they've endorsed, and they've been active participants around the elections in one way or another. But this year, for these municipal elections, the guerrillas have adopted a new strategy. And the strategy is to turn people away from the polls. And they've been successful in some areas. Now, one of the reasons they may have changed their strategy towards elections is that for a decade, there have been leftist candidates, and many of those candidates have been assassinated. And frankly, they've said, we've tried to play the Democratic game, and that game has led only to more violence and death. I don't know why they've adopted this new strategy, but it is a new development, and it's troubling.
It's interesting, and I now want to bring our other guest into the conversation, Jael Quiroga of Reinitiate, the director of this NGO human rights group based in Colombia. I heard on CNN this past weekend from a reporter in Colombia. This was the CNN program where they bring you sort of the government reporters from state television. And she was asked by the anchor, what is it that these guerrillas want? What do they represent? Why don't they want people to vote in the elections? And she said simply that they are against democracy. I should say also that Jael Quiroga is being translated by Winifred Tate of the Columbia Media Project. Would you assess guerrillas as being opposed to democracy?
No, yo no estoy de acuerdo de que la
guerrilla
esté en contra de la democracia. ¿Sí? Porque entraríamos a mirar cuál es la democracia.
We should really think about what democracy is.
La democracia solamente es las elecciones.
If it's just elections in Colombia.
O la democracia real significa otras
cosas. Or if real democracy means other things.
O sea, la garantía para que participe la oposición política.
The guarantee that political opposition can participate.
La oposición política en Colombia ha sido liquidada, exterminada.
The political opposition in Colombia has been completely annihilated and exterminated.
Y no ha tenido esas garantías de un país democrático.
Never had the guarantees that exist in a real democracy.
Y la prueba de ello es el genocidio que se ha cometido contra la Unión Patriótica.
The proof of this is the genocide that's been carried out against the Patriotic Union.
Y los más de 60,000 muertos asesinados.
More than 60,000
de la oposición política
deaths of activists and political activists since 1985.
So what is your assessment of the U.S. government now giving military aid that had been targeted supposedly for the drug war to be directly used against guerrillas? What will this mean for people on the ground in Colombia?
Estados Unidos siempre tendrá un argumento para intervenir.
The United States is always going to make up excuses to intervene in the internal affairs and politics of different countries.
Estados Unidos ahora tiene el pretexto de la droga para
United States
reprimir
now uses the pretext of the war on drugs
cualquier manifestación
to oppress any kind of demonstration against their interests.
Your group, Reiniciar, which is reinitiate in English, what does it focus on doing in Colombia?
Nosotros somos defensores de derechos
humanos.
We're
human rights defenders.
Yo estaba en una región
I was in a region
armado,
where there was armed conflict
llamada Barranca Bermeja y el Magdalena
in
Medio.
Barranca Bermeja in the Middle Magdalena Valley region.
Yo tuve que salir de allí con otros compañeros porque
I had to leave there with
no
other coworkers
garantías para defender los derechos humanos
because we had no guarantees to protect us while we were trying
y
to protect
tuvimos que radicarnos
human rights.
En la capital de la República.
We had to move to the capital in
y
Bogotá.
Empezar a hacer trabajo internacional.
And start doing international work because in the regions we couldn't.
Who were you most threatened by?
A nosotros nos no solo nos amenaza, sino que ha habido implicados de agentes
estatales. We were not just threatened
dentro de las
by regular people, but also by state agents who were involved in the assassinations of human rights defenders and political leaders in the region.
I think it will come as a surprise to many people here that the guerrillas control of as much of Colombia as we're now talking about, 40% of the country. Is that accurate?
Sí, en el último informe del gobierno,
in the last government report,
el alto comisionado de la paz habla de que en
1985, High Commissioner for Peace says that
la guerrilla incidía en 173 municipios.
125 municipalities had guerrilla presence.
10 años después, en 1995,
10 years later, in 1995,
la guerrilla tiene una incidencia en 622 municipios.
The guerrilla has presence in 622 municipalities in the country.
Yo considero de que una intervención de los Estados Unidos en Colombia,
if the U.S. gets involved in Colombia,
lo que va a ayudar es a,
what they're going to help to do,
a producir más guerra,
is to produce more war.
Porque la idea que se tiene en Colombia en estos momentos
the
es que
people have in
Colombia se debe llegar a una negociación política del conflicto armado.
The armed conflict should reach a negotiated end.
Una negociación en la que la sociedad civil pueda hacer
where the
parte
civil society can participate as well
con sus sugerencias
with their suggestions,
en que
with
la sociedad civil pueda avalar esos acuerdos
with where civil society can actually
y
participate
ser veedor de las partes para el cumplimiento.
And make sure that the agreements are complied with.
Es reconociendo el poder que tiene el enemigo como uno se sienta a negociar.
This is what we need. We need the people to sit down and negotiate with each other.
Professor Chernick,
yes.
Right now, with the money that's going to supposedly fight drugs, triple the amount Washington sent last year, and again now being broadened out to include fighting what General McCaffrey is calling narco-guerrillas. That's referring to leftist militias. Did they have to get approval from Congress for this, or because it's for the drug war, is it done by executive order?
No, no, this is approved by Congress. But it's also within the context of the what's known as the Leahy Amendment, named for the senator from Vermont, Patrick Leahy, which says that the U.S. cannot give lethal aid to any unit within the Colombian military that is involved in human rights violations. Now, this is one of the conditions of the increased military aid, is that they can't go to units involved in human rights abuses. The difficulty with the Leahy Amendment, because it is a step forward, is that it's hard to determine which unit is good and which unit is bad, or whether you can even do such a thing within an institution and say this part's good and this part's bad. But these are the conditions under which the aid was increased and Congress has approved it.
And so are we going to see something like we saw in El Salvador, in Colombia, the U.S. being deeply involved in this war?
It's hard to say. I think not quite Salvador proportions. The U.S. is, what I see from here is that the U.S. is concerned and doesn't know what to do. On one hand, they're being pushed by allies in Colombia, military allies in Colombia, to step up the assistance to the military, and the U.S. saying, okay, but clean up your Human Rights Act. On the other hand, there are voices within the State Department and in Washington saying there's not a military solution to this conflict, that one has to look for a broader solution, something along the lines of a negotiated peace. And that argument's beginning to emerge here, too. What we don't know is how the government will come down, and likely, as often happens with U.S. policy, they'll do both at the same time, is that there will be conflicting signals. But I think there's a great reluctance, and you could even see from McCaffrey's statements, they don't want to get into a counterinsurgency war. They don't know how to deal with the drug issue, but they're very concerned about political stability, and they're going to explore both military and peace options.
Haile Quiroga, we just have a minute, but here you are in the United States. What do you suggest if people are interested in the situation in Colombia that they can do? What are you suggesting be called for from the United States?
What we're asking the international community is that people notice and take pay attention to the situation in Colombia, specifically the very serious human rights situation. The international community realize that the problem in Colombia is not the drug problem, that there's a tragedy in Colombia that's involving the whole civil society. That everyone should apply pressure to their government, specifically the United States government, the State Department. That giving aid to the Colombian Army, for example,
it's
hypocrisy, just like Professor Chernet
said.
It's sending confused signals
si quiere ayudar o no, o
regarding
quiere
if people really
want to
help
en Colombia.
Improve the situation or if they just want to support more war in Colombia.
Yo creo que una política clara de Estados Unidos sería entrar incluso a de
a
país
clear policy
amigo de
from
la paz,
the United States would come in as a friend of
armado,
peace to help mediate
que
in
si
the
bien es cierto,
armed
no,
conflict.
Que si bien es cierto no constituye toda la paz en Colombia, es un factor de violencia
which,
en Colombia.
Is the drug war is only one factor, and the guerrilla war is only one factor in police, peace in Colombia.
So are you saying no military aid to Colombia?
Ayuda militar para las drogas, que es un, puede ser un convenio, una ayuda técnica.
We could talk about technical aid.
But military aid?
El problema es... pero es que el problema de la ayuda militar es que se va en contra de la población civil residente en las zonas de conflicto armado.
That lives in the areas where there is civil armed conflict.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Jael Quiroga, director of Reiniciar, an NGO human rights group in Colombia, and Mark Chernek, professor of government and Latin American studies at Georgetown University. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I also want to thank Winifred Tate, who translated from the Columbia Media Project. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland is our New York engineer. Andy York, our Washington engineer. Thanks to Zachary Fink and Mario Murillo. Julie Drizin's our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Democracy Now! Is here weekdays at 6 and 9 in the morning here on KPFK Los Angeles 90.7 FM. It's about 10 a.m.